Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Heidi Heumann. Let me tell you a little bit about Heidi. Heidi has dedicated 26 years to advocating for trauma survivors with a passion for gun violence prevention. An award-winning director and producer of the documentary Behind the Bullet, Heidi has also authored the book Beyond the Bullet, Personal Stories of Gun Violence Aftermath, and contributed numerous articles highlighting the devastating impact of gun violence on victims and their families. As a board member of Brady United Against Gun Violence, Women Donors Network, Develop Africa, and the Trauma Intervention Program, Heidi has combined deep empathy with extensive experience in trauma work and community organizing to foster more meaningful conversations about gun violence. She approaches advocacy with fresh perspectives, aiming to create solutions rooted in compassion and dialogue. Her writing has appeared in USA Today, Ms. Magazine, The Seattle Times, The Oregonian, and The Huffington Post. Her widely recognized four-part series, My Month with a Gun, was published in Ms. Magazine, The Daily Beast, and The Denver Post. Her debut memoir, Dumb Girl, will be published in August of 2025. And with that, Heidi, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. I've been looking forward to our conversation.
Oh, great. So nice to be here with you, Dave. Thank you.
My pleasure. And when your publicist, Angel, reached out to me, your background resonated with me deeply, both from your work with as an advocate for gun safety, with your history of trauma, because as somebody who teaches death, dying, and bereavement and has done a lot of bereavement support, I'm very sensitive to the damage that gun violence can do to families, can do to communities. And as an addiction professional, I have dealt with individuals who've experienced trauma in addition to the addiction, or that has been a result of the addiction. So your background resonated with me deeply. And I emailed Angel and said, yeah, let's set something up. And so here we are.
Yeah, and I think we do have a lot of synergy. I've listened to several of your interviews on your podcast, and you have such interesting guests. I was listening to you interviewing Carrie Brody and her experience with her child dying, and it's just, you do an incredible job. So you're attracting a lot of really interesting people who are living incredibly rich lives.
Well, and that's been the aim of the podcast, is to feature individuals who have incredible stories, who are doing incredible things. And even though my name is attached to the podcast, the platform is always my guest contributor when they're on. The mantra of the podcast is we're all students and teachers. So every guest puts me in a position where I'm a student and I'm learning. You know, my audience, I think, resonates with that message. That makes me content.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I love that.
So for the audience, it's going to be seeming like we're going to be talking about two different perspectives. One is your memoir, Dumb Girl, and also is your work as an advocate for gun safety. And these are going to seem like two very separate paths, but as we're going to find out, it's interconnected. Because reading your memoir, which, by the way, was powerful, transparent, you put everything out there. It was obvious in terms of reading the structure of your memoir, in terms of how you recalling your childhood experiences informed your work as a gun safety advocate. So these two worlds are going to be coming together. So
You're right. It's not an obvious connection. You're right on that.
But it's connected.
Yeah. You know,
and all we got to do is actively look for that and connect the dots, and we'll see that it all fits. So But my first question for you, I know there was one moment, one event that transformed you into an activist for gun safety. Can you elaborate more on that, Heidi?
Yeah, so there really was a moment for me where I got involved in the gun violence prevention world, and that was the Columbine High School massacre. I had graduated from Columbine 13 years before that massacre, and Dave Sanders, who was the one teacher that was killed in that massacre, had been my basketball coach and typing teacher at Columbine. And he had also coached my three brothers. And so when I found out that he had died, I was a stay-at-home mom at the time. I had a one-year-old and a four-year-old up in Portland, Oregon, and I flew to his funeral to pay respects and then also for the mass memorial. And I remember sitting there, Dave, at his funeral, and his name was also Dave Sanders. I'm looking at these former teachers who were such big people in my life, and they had red, swollen eyes from crying. Everyone just looked like they were in complete shock, which they were. And it was just something, as I was sitting there at his funeral, shifted in me or broke in me. I don't know what the right word is, but something happened. And I thought, this is ridiculous. This is so sad and so tragic and so unnecessary. All these lives, these young people's lives. And Dave Sanders, who was an incredible coach, an incredibly empathetic teacher, for them to be mowed down at school. I have to do something. I have to get involved in this issue and stop this kind of thing from happening again. And so that's what I did. And that was the moment where I came home and I told my husband, I said, I need to work on gun control. I have time. I've got the two kids. And also, it's just terrifying to think of. I mean, my kids were young at the time, weren't even in school yet. But to imagine them going again to the high school that I, like a high school I had been to, where this tragedy happens, I needed to stop this from happening. I certainly didn't want this to happen again to anybody, and I didn't want it to happen to me or my kids.
Yeah, I mean, there's always that one ultimate moment that, whether it affects us directly or indirectly, that causes a perspective shift, gets the activist part of us activated, moving, and we feel like we have to do something. And you don't have to experience that tragedy directly, but at the same time, when a community is affected, and you are part of that community, it's understandable that it would have that kind of an impact. But let me tell you, when I was reading about your relationship with Dave Sanders, he just struck me as a type of teacher that I would have loved having, because he took an interest in his students, I think, beyond the classroom. And I remember, if you don't mind me getting into this, I know you were a three-sport athlete in college.
Yeah, I was all the sports athlete. I was only allowed to do three per year. So yeah, that's what I did.
So if you could have done four or five, you probably would have.
If they would have let me, yeah.
They would have let you, but he was your basketball coach, and you had made varsity, I believe, as a freshman. Am I correct?
So our school, we didn't have a freshman. The freshmen were in the junior high.
Okay.
And so our school was, you were in the high school sophomore, junior, and senior year.
Okay.
And it was like that until my senior year. Then they brought the freshmen up. But yeah.
But then he also demoted you to JVs, but he sat down and explained to you why he did that. He just wanted you to come into your true natural ability, and felt that, and I'm paraphrasing this, that would be probably maybe a less pressured environment for you to do it. And he just said, don't try to control everything. Trust your natural talent. And once you did that, you were back on the varsity again. And that's what impressed me most about him, because he sat you down and explained, look, this isn't a demotion. I'm looking at the bigger picture here, and I see the potential in you to succeed, and I see the potential in you to do great things, and this is how I want to set this up for you. And that's really what impressed me most about the way he handled that situation with you.
I think you're right, and you know, as you talk about this, I feel feelings coming up, and he did that in such a loving way, and I didn't recognize it at the time. So I had made the varsity. and I was so happy and so proud of myself, but I wasn't doing well. And he recognized that what was happening is I was really trying, and what that was doing for me physically and probably physiologically is I'm being really tight. And so I think about him all the time, and I think about this moment all the time, because it comes back to me in different ways, whether I'm working on a film, whether I'm working on this book, whether I'm trying to give advice to my kids who aren't taking it, whatever, is I'm trying and trying. And there's a point of where you have to chill and relax and let the things happen. And that was the lesson he was trying to teach me. And he said, Heidi, don't try so hard. And I remember at the time thinking, what? Like, that's not a thing. You don't not try. You're supposed to try. But he was right. And it's this, like, just let things happen a little bit, trust yourself. And then you're a good enough athlete and you're good enough at what you do that you can make this happen. And so he was right. And again, this lesson constantly comes back to me in my life now, which is decades later. And that lesson was incredible.
Well, if you presume competence, if you treat somebody as if they're competent or as if they're capable, they are going to respond in that way. As a professor myself at Utica University, I tell my students, I don't care what you got in other classes. I'm going to treat you as if you're capable of doing great things.
Yeah.
And
then people rise to that.
Yeah, absolutely. They realize that you see something in them that they may not have seen in themselves. And that you trust that they're going to meet the expectations or the goals of the class and do it to the best of their ability. But I also like the fact, and which aligns with my philosophy, is you build relationships with students. And that's the first thing, is you build a relationship. And then from there, that student will learn. And one of the things I've noticed, I know we're going to get to your advocacy work in a minute. One of the things I've noticed with your work is that you focus on building relationships first.
Yes, that is the key to me feeling authentic, me feeling like I'm making a difference. And it's the thing that was missing from me from my own childhood that I'm projecting constantly to other people. I love valuing people, and I've gotten hurt before because I trust people maybe a little bit too much and I'm not maybe on guard enough. But I've also decided in those moments where that's happened, I love that about myself. I love valuing people and seeing how they respond to it.
Yeah, and if people feel valued, regardless of what their perspective is, they're at least going to feel heard. And you may not come to agreement on many things or alignment on many things, but at least you've respectfully heard and you come to an understanding. In terms of what the other person is feeling. You can't do that is if you don't place a premium on building a relationship first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, this is kind of a nice segue into your soon-to-be-released memoir, Dumb Girl. Tell our audience how you came up with the title and why you felt now was the time to share your story.
Yeah, great question. So when I was growing up, I had three brothers and my dad and my mom, and it was a very toxic male upbringing. I, as being a female, my female attributes were not embraced. So I got really involved in sports and athletics because that was something I could do that was sort of acceptable in my family. That was valued. We would all play tennis as a family. We'd shoot basketballs outside on the driveway, that kind of thing, skiing. But there was a saying, a mantra that was going on throughout my childhood, and it was, don't be a dumb girl. And it got shortened to DBADG. And so I referred to it several times throughout the book. And what that meant was if I saw a spider and screamed, or I became emotional and was going to cry, or I had to pee, or anything that seemed weak or girl-like, I was told DBADG. And this happened all the time. If I would fall when I was on the ski slope and get hurt, a DBADG, just, you know, sort of suck it up. And so I really started embodying that. And I tried not to be dumb. And I tried not to be a girl in every way that I could. And there was a moment in fifth grade where this really came to me, where I had failed a social studies class in fifth grade, and my dad found the F on my report card and was just incensed. And he was a physically abusive, anger management problem kind of guy. And he was extremely upset. And after taking this beating and what seemed to me like an incredibly long night, he told me to take all of my F papers and he had me tape them up onto my bedroom wall. And he said, after I got done, he said, "Now all your friends will see how stupid you are." And that, Dave, that wall, I went to sleep to, and I woke up to that wall every single morning and every single night for months. And that, as a fifth grader, what, I was like 11, that really puts an impression on you. And I started really believing that I was dumb. And so it hurt me in a lot of ways, not only just that way. So I didn't ever let friends come over anymore because I certainly didn't want them to know this about me. And I started cheating on tests and papers and everything I could because I couldn't chance me failing another class or failing another test or whatever. And I would forge, if I did bad on a test, I would forge his signature and that kind of thing. So I, what that's done is throughout my whole life, I have believed that I am dumb. And I believe that when I walk into a room, and I still struggle with this, honestly, I walk into a room and I think that everyone else in the room is smarter than me. They know more. And I have to work to rise to them. So that's the insidious part, is it continues even in my adult 57-year-old brain. I still struggle with that. Even with all the accomplishments that I've had in my life, I still struggle with that.
Well, you know, an early experience does matter. And mm-hmm. just when we least expect it, it's kind of like grief. When we least expect it, it kind of sneaks up on you. And there, in as much as we've accomplished, as much good as we've done, as much validation as we've gotten from individuals who are not our family, we still struggle. There'll still be times where the human experience bites us right in the butt and we start questioning. But then again, that can also be a gift, because I think, you know, we can translate that into just being, getting more support, checking out a situation further, making sure that you have your X's and O's taken care of, your T's crossed and your I's dotted. And I know that's one of the ways that you basically, when you were in a situation where all the childhood messages were coming up, you sought support. You asked questions. You rehearsed. You and Dave went through, I think, mock rehearsals on a couple of debates and presentations you were supposed to do. So you made sure you were prepared because of what happened to you and how you experienced early childhood. You made sure, well, it's not going to happen again. So were able to develop those skills to attain the accomplishments that you've attained and to build the relationships that you have built.
Yeah, that's right. And I talk about it in the book about how I struggled so much with this. I've constantly felt like I'm this fraud and I don't want people to know that I'm dumb. So I need to do all these things so that they don't figure that out. And so there was a moment where this friend of mine said, "Wait, so you wrote a book and you didn't have a major of English in college. You did a film. You've never been to film school. Like, how can you even just do that?" And I realized that this isn't a thing that's a deficit. It's actually a superpower because feeling like you're dumb, it allows you this freedom, which I didn't quite realize till this friend asked me this question. And I have this freedom. I'm not struggling with my ego all the time. So I go into a room and I can be authentic and I can ask questions. I cannot know what I'm doing and I will seek support. And okay, how do I figure this out? How do I figure out how to do a film? Oh, I need to work with somebody who has done a film before. And so that's how I learn. And once I figure that out, oh gosh, Dave, it was such a relief, because I didn't struggle with, oh, what if people find out I'm dumb? It was like, yeah, I don't know things and not everybody knows things. So this is a common experience, actually. And so I just need to find out the people who know the answer. And then that's how I can move forward on things. And I'm proud of the things I've done, because I do over prepare, or maybe that's the wrong word, but I prepare a lot. Because I'm double checking everything all the time to make sure I haven't made a mistake. And so what that does is then it creates more quality I work really hard on the relationships that I form around the projects that I'm doing. And that's part of that diligence that comes from feeling like you've got to work hard to rise to the task.
Well, one of the things I took from reading your book is that the challenges that you had because of the physical abuse you went through with your father, your mom's alcoholism, all of those challenges, you developed some very usable skills and important skills to help you do the film documentary on a sensitive subject, to write your books. So in that sense, you were able to take a look at the yin and yang of the situation. You took a look at those challenges and said, how can I rise above that? What can I do now to achieve my goals? And what skills can I develop antithetical to the messages that I heard growing up?
Yeah. And I think it even goes beyond that, because all my projects that I've done, whether it was my first book, the article, My Month with the Gun, the other articles I've written, or the film, and even this book, it was like I had a question, a burning question, which I know you relate to, which is my first book that I wrote, Beyond the Bullet, about 19 people who'd been impacted by gun violence. I wrote that soon after the Columbine High School massacre because I wanted to know the answer to the question, how do you get out of bed the day after you find out your child's been killed or died? That astonished me because, you know, I was at home with my one-year-old and my four-year-old trying to imagine, and then watching the Columbine parents and how they were dealing with it in such different ways, right? Some people became gun control advocates, some left town, some sued, some were really angry, just all kinds of different reactions. But I didn't understand how you could have such horrible loss and continue with life. I still don't understand that, and I hope I never understand that. So that was the question I was trying to find out when I was interviewing all these folks for my book. And then I found out that my authentic yearning for this answer was helpful for them, because then that allowed them to tell their story in this unfiltered way, not be interrupted in some support group that they're in where they can only speak for about 10 minutes. And I authentically wanted to know everything. Like, how do you do with this?
Well, what's important for anybody who's experienced any type of catastrophic loss, regardless of cause of death, is for their story to be heard as many times as it's needed to be heard. I've always said, Heidi, that if an individual gifts me with their story of their most intimate loss, of their most intimate challenge in their lives, then I've created a safe enough space for them to trust me with that. And that's a gift for me. Their stories are a gift. They inspire me, and I learn from that. And a lot of times people ask, well, how can you continue to do this work? How can you sit with people who've experienced life-altering loss? How can you sit with their grief? And I say, well, how can I not?
Yeah. Well, and I, you know, it makes me think about this sort of dumb girl thing. I was so worried about re-traumatizing people. So asking questions that was going to be hard for them to answer. And remember, there was a woman who worked at the OPB, which is the NPR affiliate here in Portland, Oregon. And I went out to lunch with her and I asked her, how do you interview people and how do you not traumatize them? And so we talked about all this stuff. And then as I was interviewing this one woman, Michelle, up in Seattle, whose son was killed at a party. No, I said, I can't keep interviewing you. I'm worried I'm going to harm you. And she said, no, this is like the first time anybody's ever really asked me what happened and how I felt about it and how I live my life. And this is so helpful to me. I don't want to stop this interview. And I said, okay, we'll continue. But it was, I was really worried about it. And then I realized, oh, I'm not taking from her, which was what my worry was. I'm giving to her by giving her time and my full attention and my authenticity.
And you know, one of the myths that a lot of people will subscribe to is that if we talk to a loved one about the person who died, we're going to make them more upset. And I used to tell people, I'm already upset. So if you want to talk about my daughter, you want to talk about my mother, you want to talk about any of my other ancestors, that's the greatest gift you can give me, because it gives me an opportunity to share some memories. And what individuals want is their stories to be heard. They want you to know intimately the person who they lost. And in the cases of individuals, shooters who you interviewed in your Behind the Bullet documentary, they understand, here's the rationale, here's what we did, here's why my Second Amendment rights are so important to me. And you did that with grace, with dignity, and with respect. And that's a gift, particularly with such a polarizing topic.
Yeah, and I really did try, and it was incredibly challenging, because when you're somebody who's working on gun violence prevention and talking to legislators and trying to figure out what are the solutions, whether it's legislatively or whether it's about gun safety educational programs or helping people understand the importance of locking guns up when you have kids around and this kind of thing, you start to see the other side as the problem. And I really was uncomfortable with that, because we're all human beings in this world and we all want the same things. We want our kids to grow up healthy and happy and turn into productive, happy adults. And so putting my opponents as bad because they own guns or whatever, that didn't make sense to me. And I wanted to explore this. I was tired of this back and forth of like, either you're pro-gun or anti-gun, or I didn't like the duality of that. And so I was really curious, and I just wanted to know, well, if you buy a gun for self-defense and then it gets used either in self-defense or some other way, what happens to you? So it's a similar question of how do you get out of bed after somebody Yep. that you love has been killed? It's the same thing. Like, how do you take a life, even if it's justified? How do you take a life and then continue living life? What does that do to you? And I felt like this was missing from the conversation, Yep. Especially with gun owners. I didn't want to put my spin on it. And I did a film that I'm very proud of, because I don't show my personal viewpoints about gun ownership. I just tell the stories of these four people who have shot and killed somebody and how it's impacted their life. And it was really interesting to me to go into that world. I don't hang out with gun owners. That's not, I'm in a different bubble. We talk about bubbles, right? And so I wanted to know what's motivating them. And I didn't want to hate them. I wanted to understand.
Yeah, because, I mean, hate is such a strong word. And hate is the thing that's going to separate us. We need to understand, even if we don't agree with it, why is gun ownership so important? And the tack that you took was on gun safety. That if Yeah. my child is going to a house, I want to find out, are you a gun owner? Are your guns locked up? I don't care if I'm not disrespecting your Second Amendment rights. I just want to make sure my son is going to be safe. Because I think, as you mentioned in your book, I think it's like 60% of gun violence or shootings, they occur in the home. Am I something to that effect? Or am
oh,
I wrong?
Yeah. So 40% of homes with children have guns in them. Many are unlocked and loaded. And so the campaign that you're talking about, which was my very first introduction to gun violence prevention, and I love this campaign because this campaign encourages parents to ask if there's a gun in somebody's home before you let your kids play there. And so what it ended up being is it's not a debate or a judgment about gun ownership. It's about you're coming alongside with another parent and you're saying, I want my kids to be safe in your home. You want your kids to be home safe. So what is the rating of the shows that the kids are going to be watching? Who's supervising? Are there dangerous dogs? And then also, do you have any guns in your home? And so but I'm not saying if you have guns in your home, I think you're a terrible person. It's irrelevant. But it's just, if you do have guns in your home, if you could have them be locked up, that would be fantastic. And if the ammunition is stored separately, then that's the perfect scenario. And so, but asking at the beginning was really challenging because it felt like I was asking a personal question, right? So the first time I asked somebody if they had guns in their home, I felt like I was asking them, hey, how much money do you make? Right? Or something like that. And so what I found out is when you phrase it as a safety question, then you're just having a conversation And I used all kinds of different techniques. Mostly people answered with, yeah, we do have guns, but they are locked up. Or, oh, I'm so glad you asked this question. Or the simple, no, we don't have any guns. But then it got people to ask. It sort of was contagious, this campaign. And then I would, you know, sometimes if I didn't really know them, I'd use humor and I'd say, hey, my child is not allergic at all to peanuts, but they're deathly allergic to guns. Do you have any guns in your home? Or I would say, my son, man, he gets into everything. So can, like, I'm worried about him getting into stuff. But do you have any guns that are in your home that he might get into? So using a little bit of brevity and humor, and I think that helped as well, because every situation was a little bit different. But ultimately, no, not one person was ever offended by me asking this question. And ultimately, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, when I got hesitant about it, I thought, well, what if they do and something happens to my child? Can I live with myself that I wasn't brave enough to ask this question? And so that was the ultimate, like, no, I'm not willing to get a call in 2 hours saying that there's been an accident.
Well, and you know, the other thing that I think coming at the whole gun issue from a safety perspective, if you're asking, you know, about safety, what you're also communicating to the person who believes in gun ownership is that you're concerned not only for your children's safety, but for their children's safety.
Absolutely.
And
yeah,
that tends to, I think, take the defensiveness out of the conversation. Like you said, I'm not questioning your right to own guns. I just want to make sure that my child and your child are in a safe environment when they're playing.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
And regardless of ideology, as parents, I think we can all align with the fact that we want our kids to be safe.
Yeah. Ultimately, that's what it comes down to. That's where the common ground is.
Yeah. And I think and we're going to get into common ground in a minute, but I want to ask you first, I know you carried a gun during a month-long period of your life. And we talked a little bit about that in the bio. Tell our audience really what you learned from that experiment, what you discovered about yourself, what you discovered in general about the gun conversation.
Yeah, so I was doing all these events, like Asking Saves Kids campaign, press events where I was at a park and I was sharing the message of the Asking Saves Kids campaign. And I felt like that was really important. I was doing some vigils after massacres, some protests, and these guys kept showing up to my events with guns on their hips. And it was astonishing to me because I'm like, we're in a park. It's the middle of the day. Why do they have guns on their hips? What is it that they know that I don't know? And so I'm a big believer in the, like, walk in other people's shoes before you judge them kind of idea. And so I thought, well, why don't I find out what it's like for them? Like, why are they and how does it make them feel? So I got a permit to carry a concealed weapon, and then I bought a Glock, and which is the sort of typical cop gun that you see on every TV show, right? And so I either carried it in my purse or on my hip. And for a month, I had it with me all the time. At home, I had it locked up in a safe, carried it to, I went to yoga class, I went to church, I went grocery shopping, I went to restaurants, I went to business meetings, I went to the bank. Yes, you can take a concealed gun into a bank, which shocked me. I didn't take it to my kids' school because that was illegal. So I followed the law. And in my state, at the time I was living in the state of Washington, I did the minimum, which was there was no safety requirements or any kind of training, which astonished me as well. So anyway, what happened was I found out that the gun, having that gun with me all the time, made me super paranoid and fearful. And so one of the stories that I talk about is in the book is typically when I go to bed, and my husband traveled a lot, so he'd be out of town, and I would be going to sleep and, you know, your mind's going and I'm thinking, oh, I need to pick up this and this from the grocery store. And, oh, my son didn't finish that science project and it's due in 2 days, so I need to get on him about it. And I'm having all these mom thoughts. Oh, I forgot to pay that bill. And so that's what I would usually go to sleep to, is these great thoughts? No, they weren't great thoughts, but that's what happens in a mom mind, right? Well, what happened was when I had the gun with me, I would lay in bed And I would notice every creak, every sound, first of all. And then I would start ruminating and thinking, okay, if a bad guy comes into the house, he's going to come up the stairs to the landing. And then, okay, I'll do the code on the safe, and then I'll get the gun. And then if he's going to try and get in my bedroom, I'll shoot him. Oh my gosh, but then he's going to die on the landing, and then my son's going to hear it, and he's going to get up, and then he's going to see a dead body in our house. And I'm like spinning, and I can't go to sleep because I'm like having all these thoughts. And it was ridiculous. And that is not how I usually think. I mean, my husband did travel, but I'm not the paranoid type, and I don't think about these kinds of things. So that really surprised me. And then the other story I tell was I was at a business meeting up in Seattle, and I'm in one of those traditional parking garages that smell like urine, right? And sort of darkly lit. So I'm on the third floor, and I go down the stairs. And as I'm going down the stairs, I've got the gun in my purse because I'm on my way to a business meeting. I'm wearing a pencil skirt and feeling great about myself and some high heels. So I'm going down the stairs, and this guy comes up behind me, and I'm very aware of him. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this guy's behind me. Like, what if he attacks me? I'm by myself in the stairwell. And so I put my hand in my purse and I put my hand around the gun, and I think, okay, if he does anything, I'll shoot him. And then I realize, wait, he's above me and behind me. So the only way I can shoot him before something bad happens is I need to turn around and point the gun at him. But I don't know that he's a bad guy. And so I start sweating, and I'm just in my head, I'm freaking out. And we get down to the bottom of the stairwell. He goes right and I go left. And I had to stop and like put my hands on my knees and bend over and think, oh my God. I thought, again, how ridiculous is this? That I didn't need to think about all these things. He was just a dude going to a meeting, and I was just a person going to a meeting as well. And so I would go to the grocery store and I'd look at people's waist and who else is carrying. And so I got an understanding of, I feel like my experience was not unique. And I feel like people who openly carry concealed weapon, I think there's a thought process for them that is different than mine that I think the gun brings. And it actually makes me a little bit sad because I think life is hard enough, and then to bring in this extra part of it. But then I'm also aware that there are people who have been attacked or people who have had terrible things happen to them, and that allows them to maybe feel a sense of security. I don't know, but that was my experience. But what it did for me is it allowed me to have empathy for people who feel like they need to carry. And I wish we lived in a world or a country where people didn't feel like they had to carry a gun with them.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I was thinking of before we came on the air is, you know, looking at the perspective of somebody who carries a gun. Are they carrying a gun not just for show or for a show of power, but is it because they don't feel safe? For the same reasons that a lot of trauma individuals or victims of trauma like yourself don't feel safe, but for different reasons. But it's this common ground of, do I have to carry a gun to feel safe? And if that's the case, you're right, that's, I don't want to call it a sad state of affairs, but it'd be something that would be very concerning to me.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Because statistically, if you have a gun in your home, you're more likely to be killed by it, or somebody is more likely to die from suicide, which is surprisingly 60% of gun deaths are suicide. So you bring a gun into your home.
And that's a statistic I was trying to do.
Yeah, that's where you got the 60%.
That's where I got the 60% from. So thanks for rescuing me on the back end.
Yes,
of that,
you are correct, just in the wrong category. But yeah, so it's... I think it's just, it feels better and feels like you're safer, but you're not. And then the issue is when you're a gun violence prevention advocate is talking about statistics, that does not override the feeling. And that's the challenge. And that's the rub is how do you talk to gun owners and let them know that having a gun in their home makes them less safe, when that they feel like it makes them safer. And that's a lot of why I did my film, because I wanted to show, look, these people brought guns into their home so that they could feel safer. But a child was killed, an 8-year-old killed a 5-year-old, a woman attempted suicide, a guy shot somebody on the street who was shooting at him and went to prison for 10 years. And then one of the people in the film shot an intruder in his home, shot him in the back, watched him bleed out on his front lawn. But then now he's paranoid. He's got tripwires around his house. He can't sleep at night, has nightmares. And so there's a moral injury that happens when these things happen. But I didn't want to blast statistics at people. I wanted to say, okay, you do what you want, but here's what could happen. And then you make the judgment.
Yeah. You plant the seeds and let individuals use their free will to decide what's best for them or where their truth lies. So, I know we've talked a lot about the importance of listening, but I want to frame this in a question for you. Why is listening without judgment an asset in polarizing issues such as gun safety? Can listening without judgment, can we help us find common ground on such a very controversial issue?
Yeah, I think we can find common ground. And it does come from listening, because if you would have interviewed me before I did my film, so in 2017, 18, I wouldn't have empathy for people who have guns or feel like they need guns in their homes or carrying them around with them. And so I think, just like anything, we're so polarized, especially now, and we aren't listening to each other. And we're not considering each other's perspectives, and no one is wanting to walk in each other's shoes, for sure. And so I think that the common ground, that listening and trying to understand people's perspective and give them a little bit of grace, I think that is where we break down the polarization and find common ground. And then we talk about, like I said, with the Asking Saves Kids campaign is a perfect example about how can we reframe things so we're talking about the same thing. How are we talking about safety? How are we talking about loss and trauma and the horrible things that happen to all of us? And then also just realizing everybody that we meet, if you scratch just a little bit below the surface, there is great pain. And I'm so aware of that. And so my husband Dave laughs at me, because we'll be in the car and somebody's driving at 40 miles an hour on the left lane, right? He's like, get out of the way. And I'll say, well, maybe they have a cake in the car, right? So I'm constantly, and I do this all the time, I reframe things about someone's acting weird or disruptive. I'm always looking for the narrative of why are they acting this way? Why? Maybe there's a reason. I think there always is a reason. I mean, some people are just jerks for sure. But I like to live in the world where I try and find the reasons why people are acting the way they're acting.
Well, just as an aside, another check mark in the plus column for you is you have a husband by the name of Dave. And I think that's a great name. So
there you go. Yeah, yeah.
If anything else, if it was borderline whether we were going to have you on the program, the husband named Dave, that cinches it. That's a tiebreaker. So
fabulous, fabulous. Yeah, I will let him know, and he will hold that over me forever. So thanks for that, Dave.
I could edit this part out of the podcast, so if you want me to. So he never has to hear that. So
okay.
So, but got to ask you, from your perspective, what is the lasting impact of childhood trauma, and how does abuse shape self-worth, relationships, and decision-making?
So it affects everything. I think when you experience childhood abuse, whether it's physical, sexual, emotional, I think there's a physiological change in your brain, number one. The way your brain is connecting things as your frontal lobe is being developed, it changes everything, and it changes the perception of who you are and who you are in the world and how you interact with others. It's definitely affected me. We talked before about this self-perception that I have of being dumb, and that's just a really hard thing to overcome. And I continue to work on that. I remember when I first met my husband, we would we'd be on the couch and he would sort of lift up his arm to put his arm around me. And I would put my hands up thinking that he was going to hit me. And he was like, I'm not going to hit you. What are you getting? Why are you being defensive like this? And I would have to explain to him, like, yeah, because I don't assume that I'm in a safe environment and with safe people. And so, and that continues to happen. I'll say to him, thank you so much for being, you know, so nice to me and supporting me. And he's like, why wouldn't I be? And so I think there are these ramifications where we make assumptions about people when we're abused as children, then we sort of think that everybody is abusive and we don't trust our instincts because we were told as children that you're wrong. And yes, I'm angry, but you know, your dad is angry, but he says, no, I'm fine. And, but then he hits you. And so you view the world as unpredictable. And I think in this, and women, we are not kind to ourselves. And we come to the conclusion that it's something wrong with me. And that's why I'm being abused, because that's the only thing that makes sense as a child. And so then you carry that into an adult. And then that's the challenge, is taking these survival skills that you use as a child. And what happens is when you become an adult, they no longer serve you. They actually go against you. You don't have to protect yourself from people hitting you, but you act as if you do. And so that just continues. The ripple of childhood abuse is just incredible. And we were having a conversation earlier about your work in the addiction field. And I'm so aware the amount of people that are self-medicating, right? Because of they're dealing with the ramifications of abuse and trauma and abandonment. And so alcohol and drugs and pot is like, that's a way to self-medicate.
It sure is, particularly in response to the abuse, or if you're in an alcoholic family system or a drug addicted family system, abuse can just be part of the deal as well, too, as part of that dysfunction. So it works both ways. But the message you get growing up is that the message we get from our parents in that those type of situations is that we're not lovable. And
we
have to figure out, well, what do we got to do to earn their love? And one of my favorite books, if not my favorite books, on the afterlife of Billy Fingers, says something about, to the effect that, why should you have to earn love when you were born with that already? And we're born as lovable human beings, but the conditions that were placed on us because of being in unhealthy family systems, I'll love you if you do this. I'll love you if you don't be a dumb girl and don't be a girl. Those are the messages that we get, that love has conditions on. And we learn that the world isn't a safe place. So when we go out there, any type of cue, you're very hypervigilant to, if somebody's raising an arm, that's a cue that you're going to get smacked.
Yeah.
Based on past history. And our histories follow us wherever we go. There's something about generational trauma that if the rules and the patterns of behavior aren't altered from generation to generation, the genetic code doesn't have to be altered, but the behaviors are going to be the same, passed down from generation to generation, if something doesn't change to flip that script. So you learn the world isn't a safe place, and you learn to protect yourself at all costs until you can determine whether or not where you're at is safe.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about, I'm involved in this organization called Sibling Sexual Abuse Organization. And we talk a lot about this, and our ability, our perceptions are so heightened as to survive this childhood, because you're constantly assessing what's safe, what's not, who do I need to be nice to, how do I deal with people that are hurting me. And so then when you become an adult, you still have that ability and that skill, and it can be used. And I feel like I've turned that skill into something that's been really helpful for me, because as I'm interviewing people, I can perceive the sort of nonverbal communication that happens, and the way people talk and the way people say things. I feel like I can understand and ask the correct question that can be helpful to them in my interviewing, because I have this sort of super skill of perception that I think a lot of people don't have. I know, and it causes, with my husband, I'll see things like we'll go into a grocery store and I'll say, oh my gosh, did you see that lady? And he'll say, what are you talking about? But I'll know all kinds of things that I've perceived from somebody who is in some kind of distress, and he won't even recognize it at all. But it's because I'm safe now and I don't need to do this, but I don't know how to not do it. Yeah. And so I'm constantly assessing what is safe, who's safe in my environment, whether it's at the grocery store, eating out for dinner, or in my own family.
Well, and hypervigilance is something that you're always going to take with you from those situations anyway. And that has served you well, not just as a survival mechanism, but also that being funneled into attention to detail, which has allowed you to achieve what you've achieved in as both a film producer, a director, and also as an author. So, I had a good friend of mine, God rest his soul. He said, he gave me an object lesson. He goes, Dave, you know what the difference between being good and outstanding is? And I said, John, I don't know, but I'm sure you're about to tell me. And he looks at me and he goes, attention to detail. And that is so true. That it doesn't take that much more effort to pay attention to detail. We do it and we make sure that we have a product that we can be proud of and that anybody who witnesses it can believe that it's had a positive impact on their life. So,
no, and I think you're right. And it often shows up for me in my life about, which goes into our earlier conversation about, I'll write an email and I will reread it 8, 9, 10 times. And it's not even a consequential email, right? But I'm so worried that of making a mistake. And so I'll see my husband and he'll send out an email, maybe look at it once. But what that does is, so yes, it takes a lot of time. And I've sort of recognized like, yeah, this is just my process. This is what I do. Yes, it takes more time, but whatever. But then there's a quality because I'll pick up little errors or words I didn't really intend to say, or I'll start with an email that I'm irritated. And so it's not quite the tone I'm looking for. But on the eighth read, I'll have adjusted it to be the tone and the way I want to say it and exactly what I want to say. So it's the little things in life too.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm probably one of the few people that will edit my Facebook posts if there's a typographical error, but that's because of my years as a teacher and also the attention to detail mantra being firmly ingrained into my consciousness. And paying attention to detail is making sure that there's no grammatical errors, that, you know, that you put something out there that you're going to be proud of. Once you put it out there, you can't take it back.
That's right.
So, one of my last questions for you. In your book, you wrote a letter to your younger self. What do you hope victims of childhood trauma take away from it that can help them transcend their own challenges?
The letter to myself was, I was writing a letter to my 19-year-old self, a freshman in college. I had just turned 19 at the beginning of my freshman year. And I had just come from this really abusive home. I had so many insecurities and I had only just started discovering I had repressed a lot of the sexual abuse memories and they were starting to flood me. I didn't know what to do with them. I didn't know how to make sense of them. I was so hungry at that time for books, any book I could get my hands on about childhood abuse, about sexual abuse. And what I wanted to do was, I wish someone had written to me and said, you're going to be okay. It doesn't feel like you're going to be okay, but this is what's going to happen. And if I would have read this letter when I was 19, I probably wouldn't have believed it. I have a much bigger, full life than I ever could have imagined. And so what I'm hoping that this letter is for people who were in the same situation, have been in the same situation, is that they will see that you can not just survive and be okay, but you can thrive. You can have a big life. You can meet somebody who is supportive and helpful and not abusive. I mean, what should have happened to me is I should have married an abusive person. I should have become an alcoholic or killed myself. I'm not living the life that I was destined to be according to all the statistics and all the ways that people typically go out of abusive homes. And so I just wanted people to know, people who are struggling, that they can be okay. I didn't think I could be okay, and I was. And I'm thriving, and I would have never thought that would have been possible. So I really hope it helps other people.
I think it will. It's a powerful letter. In the nature and in the spirit of the book, you put everything out on the table. A letter that I think in some ways, I don't want to say exonerated yourself, but you realized that you weren't the messages that you heard growing up, that you went beyond that, that we can transcend that and that we can become empowered to co-create the reality that and life that we choose in conjunction with the universe.
Yeah, and I think that letter for me, writing it was really interesting as well, because I realized, yeah, I'm not this dumb girl that I've always thought I am. And I've always defined dumb and smart as sort of in an academic way. But, you know, I've been able to do a film. I've raised two incredible children who aren't having to go to therapy because of trauma from their childhood. So I've broken the cycle. I'm incredibly empathetic to people. I give people grace all the time. And so these are smart skills. Mm. And so redefining what smart is and what dumb is, that it was helpful to write this. And then, like I said, I really wished I could have read this when I was 19. I wouldn't have believed it, but it would have been helpful to know that there is a way out, and there is an incredible life that can happen even after such hardships. And I know you know that, Dave, from man, you've been through it.
Well, you know, everybody goes through life, and we're not going to get through this life unscathed. We're going to go through challenges. We don't have control over the challenges that we've experienced. Your challenges was growing up in a very abusive, non-validating family system, and you learn to transcend that. You learned also that intelligence isn't just book intelligence. It's knowing what resources to utilize, how to bring them together. There's an intuitive sense of knowing what you need. Like I remember for the documentary, you raised all the money in advance. And that's, you know, before you started filming. And I know there was one filmmaker who said, how'd you do that? Well, nobody does that. We just film one piece, then we raise the money. And we film another piece, then we raise the money. Well, I just thought this was the way you did it. Nobody taught you. It was just intuitively, well, I got to raise the money and then I can make the film, which makes perfect sense to me. You know, why start a film if you don't have the money to raise it? And I don't know too many people that would have figured that out. So, yeah, I mean, that in and of itself told me that you were never the messages growing up, that you were a dumb girl growing up. That told me right there. I said, that's pretty smart. That's pretty resourceful. And we measure intelligence in different ways.
Yeah, I think that's the key.
Yeah, we are certainly not the messages that we grew up with, and we can, you know, we can learn to overcome that and be more than that. And I've learned also, and you mentioned I've gone through, I mean, we could spend another hour talking just about even early childhood, where my father had left, having my mother raise me as an only child. That was one of several traumas I had growing up. But I also had a mother who was a total antithesis of my father and who raised me with the values and instilled the hard work ethic and treat people well. And if it wasn't for her, I probably wouldn't be sitting here talking with you. But we've all had our own share of challenges, and it's how we respond to those challenges that determine the quality of our life.
Yeah, that's right.
And we have a choice. We can choose not to respond. And thankfully, you chose to respond.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know what it is that was in me to do that, but something. I'm a competitive person. The sports, definitely, the athleticism, and provided that for me. And I continue that. That's definitely a thread throughout my life. I like doing the best, even with Dave Sanders saying, you just need to relax a little bit, let it happen. That's always a good reminder, because I just want to go and do everything perfect and the first time. And life has taught me that's not the way to do things.
No, you know, you just be yourself and do your best, and our best can be measured very differently depending on what's going on in our lives. So
exactly.
Heidi, is there anything else you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
No, I hope that they'll pick up my book and read it, and I hope it'll be helpful for people. As we talked about at the beginning, it's an unlikely story. Usually people who write about advocacy come at it from losing a loved one. Or if someone's been abused as a child, then their advocacy is around that. So yeah, marrying the two, an abusive childhood into gun control advocacy, those are two very different things, but they're also very common because it's all about trauma, and it's about trauma recovery and empathy for people who've experienced trauma. And so the writing of the book for me was about, I got so good at telling other people's stories, and I really loved telling their stories, but I always wondered, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
Because I have my own traumatic story, but I wasn't at the point where I could tell it because it felt so personal. So I was constantly diving into other people's traumas and asking them questions. And then I got to a point where it was time for me to tell my own trauma story and write it and then be able to talk about it. And I had so much shame around what had happened to me as a kid, which is also this insidious thing that happens. I don't know why we own it and why we think it was. When I first met my husband and I said to him, I need to tell you about something that I did. And when I told him what had happened to me as a kid, he said, I thought you said you did something wrong. And he thought I had robbed a bank. And it wasn't that I was molested. That didn't occur to him because he said, why would I think that you did something wrong when you were molested? That had nothing to do with what you wanted. So, yeah. So anyway, here I am telling my own story instead of telling everybody else's story. And it's a different way to be. And it's definitely a vulnerable feeling. But I feel like I'm at the point where I really want other people to understand what happens to kids when this happens and how it affects them. And for those who have had it happen, that they can be okay and they can have a meaningful and full life.
Thank you for that, Heidi. My last question for you is, if people want to get in touch with you, purchase your book, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, so the book's available in all the bookstores and Amazon starting on August 19th. It'll be available then. Pre-sales are obviously open now. Also, you can go to my website, HeidiHuman.com, and you can purchase it there. You can read my blogs. I'm on social media under Heidi Human Author, and you can sign up for my newsletter if you want to receive a newsletter a couple times a month. But yeah, I'm ready to go, and so grateful, Dave, for you giving me the opportunity, the platform to be able to share my story and my book. And I've just so enjoyed this conversation.
Me too, Heidi. And thank you for just being just a wonderful guest contributor today and for gracing me and my audience with your presence, with your story, and how you've transcended those challenges. I know our conversation and your journey is going to be of help to so many people who are listening. So thank you again.
Yeah, thank you.
And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.